Meditation is like life. You don't get a manual for how to live your life. You know, there are certain rules you can think about, certain guidelines are going to be helpful, but at different times, different things are going to need to apply. You're going to have to switch up your strategy. So generally in a practice, you can learn the basics of how to do a technique. You can be intelligent about how you're practicing. You can learn a little bit about or either by working with a teacher or figuring it out on your own or in community about how to take advantage of certain openings. But even having said that, there will be times when you may need to switch up your practice, and you may need to check in with a different teacher or with a different try a new strategy. And unfortunately, there is no manual that can tell you exactly when to do those things.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Jeff, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to have you here. So, you know, I actually came across your story because I know that you recently co-wrote a book called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics with Dan Harris. And I remember when I got a copy of the book and had a chance to read it, I was very intrigued by the story and you know, how it all came to be. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact has that ended up having on where you've ended up with your career and your life?
What a wicked question. Well, I moved around a lot in high school. I was at a private school when I was younger, and then my dad with just dudes, and my dad lost his job, so that didn't last. But when I was at that school, I was sort of with the nerds, basically. My only friend there was this sort of gay artist, and my other friend was I think I had two friends was also super artistic, and they were kind of outcasts. And my job at the school was I kind of just befriended every new person who arrived at the school. I was sort of a super friendly, kind of like a golden retriever, but mostly it was the nerd tribe. And then when I left, I went to a public school. This is in Toronto, in Canada, and then I fell in with the ne'er-do-well party animals. That was when I was about 16, and that was my group from then on in. Sort of the kind of partier, skater types. And then when I got to university, kind of stayed in that group. But of course, I also started getting interested in the subjects I was studying, and so there was some nerdery happening there as well. But I think that's. But to be honest, I have not thought about my high school social groups in a long time. So I hope that was an accurate answer.
Well, it's interesting. I'm curious how you go from, you know, partying and skater, you know, friends to, you know, becoming somebody who studies meditation and is, you know, really big into meditation and ends up meeting somebody like Dan Harris. So walk me through how you get from college to where you're at today.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. With the benefit of hindsight, you can start to see the patterns. And I had, when I was young, I had a lot of kind of mystical type experiences, I guess you could say. Like I was into lucid dreaming. I would have these lucid dreams where I would wake up in dreams, and I was very interested in how that worked. And I would do these things where I would kind of just try to understand how my mind was working as a kid. Like I'd have these sit on the and try to picture infinity and try to figure out all this ridiculous stuff, but you're a kid, you don't know any different. And I'd have these sort of experiences. So that kind of could set some groundwork. And then when I was a partier, I was really into psychedelics, like a lot of people. So I would have these, I would take these LSD trips and all the rest of it. But it really started from as a consequence of an accident from partying. That was when I was in Montreal. I was about 20 years old, I think it was 20 or 19, and I was high on mushrooms, and it was the night before my exams, and my friends and I were just playing football on the street and not doing the work we should be doing, and I was my usual dysregulated self climbing. I was climbing up storefronts and climbing up walls, and I finally climbed up this huge tree, and it was sort of freezing rain at the time. It was in early spring in Montreal. It was cold, and I guess I slipped, or the branch broke, and I fell. I fell like 35 feet, broke my neck in two places, hit a parked car, had a head injury, but main one was fractured C6, C7. So I ended up in the I was unconscious, ended up in the hospital, and, you know, they put me in traction. And that was just being all doped up on Demerol for weeks, actually. And they kept trying to stretch out my neck so it would be back into alignment. And I was just really out of it that whole time. Well, you know, my friends came visit me. I kind of thought it was hilarious too. Ended up having a surgery where they put cow bone in, all that stuff, and then they let me go in a halo. I had a big halo, and you're supposed to take it easy, but I was—I didn't take it easy. I just was—I decided I was determined not to learn any lessons from that, so I just kept on my ways, and it didn't end up working. So I had to have another surgery. But the main where it got interesting is when I tried to go back to school. My whole style of working, of thinking, kind of had changed. And it was like, it's almost like it went back to how it was when I was younger, when I was way more ADD when I was younger and very hyperactive. And then it seemed like maybe I was starting to grow out of the ADD a bit, but I don't know what happened. But anyway, it was the head injury. You get this thing called shearing, where when you have a big head injury, it's like the gray matter and the white matter are different densities, and they kind of shear, and you know, some tear happens or something. But all I know is I couldn't work the same way I used to. I couldn't think in the same kind of linear way. I was more to ADD than ever. So basically it made my ADD worse, and I had to come up with a whole bunch of new techniques for how to get work done, you know, like how to get my essays done. And I mean, I was never a very a responsible student anyway, but at least I would get my work done eventually. But I couldn't write the same way. I had to come up with a whole color coding system of notes to figure out so I would just go on various tangents, and I'd color code the notes, and I'd find what the through line were between the tangents. And and all that got me really interested in consciousness, like what is going on with my mind, why is this, has it changed? So I started reading up. Was when I started reading about the brain and the mind. I was big into Oliver Sacks back then. This is in the mid-90s now, early 90s. And so I just kept reading and trying to learn. I finally got through school, and then just sort of went on adventures in my 20s, but always reading up about, started to read spiritual books then, because I figured maybe there's perspectives there. Eventually, I ended up writing a book called The Head Trip that was all about all the different states of consciousness that we go through over 24 hours. So what what are these states of consciousness? What do they tell us about who we are? How do they change through day and night? How can we start to think about slow wave sleep in a way that is, you know, how can we extract the wisdom of slow wave sleep, which it has, for our lives? How can we extract the wisdom of REM sleep? What is lucid dreaming? What is hypnotic trance? What is the daydream? What does it mean to be alert? Like, I just basically create a taxonomy of different states of consciousness and wrote a book about the science of what was going on there, but also about the experience. What was the experience on the inside? And all that time, I was still very dysregulated. You know, my ADD was pretty much pretty out of control. I was just bopping around from city to job to between partners. I wasn't, I had a lot of fun adventures, but there wasn't that depth of being able to feel like I could really connect to my life, to people in my life. And when I was researching Head Trip, that's when I started meditating. I figured, okay, look, I gotta actually try some of these practices. I didn't want to just read the science. I wanted to get the first person experience. So I went on my first retreat. I think it was 2004. From there it was one of those moments, you know, where you think you're going to be the worst meditator of all time, and indeed I was. I'm not actually a very good meditator on the concentration side, and of course there's just all this. You start to see all your stuff, all your worry patterns going around and around. But even on that first retreat, I remember, you know, you look around the room. I don't know if you've done much meditation, but it's kind of moving when you look around and you just see, like, all these people are just sitting there trying to kind of be with themselves. And it's a hard thing to do. And I had a lot of friends with a lot of, you know, suffering, emotional, mental suffering, and, suffering from our circumstances and all those things. But no, right here is where it stops. You're going to sit down and sit inside who you are, inside your circumstance, and see if you can be with it in a way. And you learn that it's not about gritting and bearing it. It's not some it's not a strength move of trying to push through. It's much more a more vulnerability move of opening to it. And just seeing that that changed me. You know, not so much things that were changing in me, just seeing the commitment of other people, seeing how, you know, brave they were, and then having some good teachers. And so I just went crazy from then on in. I went nuts, and, you know, going to every possible meditation retreat I could, studying with every teacher, meditating, you know, the kind of thing you do when you're a zealot young dude, especially, or young person, decide you're going to figure it out. I thought I was going to get enlightened. I wanted to, you know, get all that stuff figured out. So I just, that kind of began that part of my journey. And I can go on from here.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so so what happened? Well, you know, this is interesting because you kind of have the people talk about meditation, you kind of get the Disney Channel version of meditation all the time, like, oh yeah, you got to meditate and it helps with stress and it'll all work out once you start practice. But my trajectory was more complicated. It didn't really look quite like that, although probably the overall arc has been in that direction. I couldn't quite find the right teacher for me. I found that there was a lot of, you know, I like to know how things work, and I like to understand the mechanics of how the practice is actually helping me, what it looks like from the inside, what it feels like, what are the qualities being developed, what are the dynamics. And I didn't find that through the prism of strict Buddhist philosophy that it was really giving me that tangible piece that I needed. It was giving me plenty of inspiration, plenty of brilliant practice suggestions, plenty of brilliant stuff all around. I mean, it's a peerless philosophical system. It's wonderful. But I just was having trouble mapping it onto my moment-to-moment experience. So I eventually found a teacher named Shinzen Young, who is a superb meditation teacher, a real genius, very much a kind of engineer brain, who has a particular way of talking about mindfulness and meditation and the skills, the muscle groups that you're building. That was really what I was looking for. Now, of course, I can look back at other teachers and see that there, many of them are saying similar things, but he had a way of talking about it that kind of hit me at that right time. So I went really deep with him, you know, going to lots of retreats and spending hundreds of hours really interviewing him. At that time, I thought I'd do another book about the deep end of practice, like what is the nature of what awakening is and the transformation that happens, and how do you tease that out from all the kind of promotional material that was out there. But meanwhile, like in my practice, it was going through these phases. So the initial phase was, it was really hard. I couldn't really meditate. My mind was all over the place. But once I got, you know, eventually it clicked. It didn't take that long, actually. And before long, I was starting to get very, very concentrated, and I was getting into these deep states of sort of absorption and openness. And I was starting to have all the classic, some of the classic effects that you hear about, you know, like these periods of my entire inner talk would just fall away, like just this utter emptiness and silence in my inner experience, or experiences of just merging with the world around me, or of kind of disappearing, it felt like, or seeing the impermanence of things, seeing how we build these models of the world from moment to moment, how everything we're inside is just this experiential bubble that's created by the mind. It doesn't mean it doesn't correspond to a real reality out there, but all we know is our own balloon. You know, it's just that's basic perceptual psychology. And it's one thing to hear about it, but when you actually notice that happening in real time, you don't ever forget it. It changes from then on in. You kind of have a little bit of skepticism in a way about the dream that you're in. You kind of say, oh yeah, it's this, you don't hold it quite as tightly. So, you know, and that back then, of course, I was, then I also got very, it was really working for me. I got very inspired and passionate about meditation. I started a meditation group in Toronto called the Consciousness Explorers Club. It was, you know, it was popular, and I felt like I could speak absolutely without any ambiguity or any reservations about how fantastic meditation was. And that's kind of, again, a stage that people go through, the stage of like being really the convert. You know, all of a sudden you're really a salesperson for a technique without ever having set out to. It kind of starts to go that way. And from the beginning, we had the Conscious Explorers Club had a very pluralistic approach. So we were interested in many different techniques, and not just meditation, but other spiritual techniques, psychotherapeutic techniques, humanist techniques. But then I entered a difficult phase of practice where all of a sudden it was really hard again. And I found my concentration sucked. And I found that all this really, really challenging emotional material from being a kid was starting to bubble up, sort of like you exfoliate, you know, through the layers. And you end up inside this old air pocket of grief and, you know, loss from things that have happened before. And also all this stuff around your challenges as a kid, you know. For me, I had a challenging childhood, so all that stuff was coming up, and sitting was really uncomfortable. And the usual advice of just, oh, you got to open to it and sit through it, sometimes that helped. Other times, that was actually the wrong advice. You know, I had to, like, go and hit a punching bag. I had to go do more physical practices, and no one was telling me this. I had just people said, just meditate more. But that wasn't the advice that I actually needed. So, you know, I slowly kind of figured this out on my own, and this, you know, and with friends. And this is what's so great about having a community. Is you just, at the Conscious Explorers Club, we say the community is the teacher. And it really means, you know, that our capacity to be honest about what we're struggling with is the main thing we have to share. And we can share that no matter who we are, no matter how much experience we have. And since my experience is going to be a little bit different from yours, getting that pooled wisdom of a larger community or group is essential. I mean, I imagine it's a similar philosophy for your podcast, because mm-hmm. in a sense, you're pooling the wisdom of all your listeners who have questions or who email you, and then also all the guests you have on. There's no one right answer. So that's a lot of stuff. Boy, I haven't feel like I've talked that long in a while. I can keep going if that's what you want me to do, or if you want to ask a question about something.
How did you get to the point where you meet Dan? I do have tons of questions, but I wanted to kind of finish with how you met Dan, and then we can get into my questions.
Sure. Okay, well, I guess it was 2012, and I wrote a piece for the New York Times called The Anxiety of the Long Distance Meditator. And it was about some of the challenges that meditators, and that was around the time I was started going through a harder experience in my practice. And it was just about this attempt on my part, I think the attempt that a lot of young people have of like, oh yeah, I'm going to get this figured out. I'm going to get enlightenment. You know, I'm going to get enlightened. And it came from a place of real suffering. Like, I was desperate to figure out how to address my situation because I was in a lot of pain then. And so I wrote a piece about this, and it was sort of a playful piece, you know. And I guess Dan read it and liked it and started emailing me, and this is before he wrote his big book. So we became friends. Just we emailed back and forth, talk nerd out about deep end stuff. And then his book came out, and he was like a mega bestseller, and that was cool. And then he asked me, he started this app, 10% Happier, which is a great app, and I do a lot of stuff on there now, asked me to come on board and just do some meditations for him. Did that, and it turned out to be popular, like my particular approach. They liked it. And since he knew I was a writer, when it came time for him to write a sequel to 10% Happier, they wanted to write a how-to book. He initially actually wanted to get Joseph Goldstein, who's a way better meditation teacher than me. He's way more experienced. I mean, just in terms of experience, you know, he's really an awesome dude. But he was kind of, you know, what's interesting about as you get older as a meditator, you get really smart, but not smart necessarily intellectually smart, although that can happen too. You get smart about your energy. You just start to realize how to be more efficient in how you're using your energy. And he was like, you know what, this trip across America, because that's what the book is. It's a road trip across the states, you know, meeting different characters and populations and trying to help them with their practice. Joseph was like, that seems like a lot of work. And he had a lot of other responsibilities. And so he opted out. And Dan was like, okay, I'll ask Jeff. So he asked me, and I was like, sure, that sounds awesome. And that's how it happened. And so that was a year ago. Did the road trip book, was a real fast turnaround, and there were some bumps on that road too, which I talk about in another podcast, in Dan's podcast, and now here we are.
So if you like The Unmistakable Creative, there's another podcast that I think you'll really like.
So how does an opera singer learn a new role? How does an actress find the perfect accent for her character? What does the director of a TV drama actually do all day? Those are the questions that Ruman alum Isaac Butler and June Thomas put to creative people every week on Working. Learn how writers outline novels, how composers get jobs and get paid, and how YouTube creators learn to look into the camera lens. Listen to Working from Slate every Sunday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Wow. So many questions come from this. You know, it's funny that you brought up the ADD thing and then, you know, you've alluded to it. And I remember that very distinctly throughout the book. So I am curious. I mean, as somebody who has built a career that clearly requires a level of sustained attention, I know this because I'm a writer myself. I mean, if you're writing pieces for the New York Times, you're writing a book. How do you do that? How do you manage that when you have the attention issues that you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. Not easily is what I would say. I mean, there's a few different ways to answer it. One, the big picture way is what I've found, what other people have found is there's our natural proclivity with attention. And then there are these sort of cycles underneath it where there are periods in your life when you find you may just be naturally a little bit more concentrated, ones are a little bit less. So when I just naturally cycle into those more concentrated periods, I just get more work done. So there is sort of that rhythm that's kind of there. And I don't really understand that rhythm. It seems to be, it's dependent sometimes on what's happening externally, but it also is just its own thing. And then there's the meditation. So within meditation, there are periods when your practice is, maybe that's the same correspondence, when your practice is going well, when it's not going as well. In periods when my practice is going well and I'm in terms of the concentration piece, that's when it's much easier for me to do all that stuff. Easier to write, easier to meditate. When the practice is not going as well, it tends to be the concentration piece that flags for me. But there are many, many, many skills that are being developed in meditation. Concentration is probably the main and most important one, but I would say as important is the skill of equanimity. And I can unpack that because it's pretty much a peerless life skill. And sensory clarity, friendliness. So the equanimity is, this is the one that was a big surprise for me when I started practicing. I had no concept for it really. The way my teacher Shin Zen talks about it is lack of friction, lack of pushing and pulling on experience. So you could say it's openness, but it's a very particular way in which you find this openness by you learn how most of the time we're sort of very subtly braced against certain experiences. So you might, when you see something you don't like, you're a little bit kind of want to avoid it, you know, or you're certain feelings you don't want to feel, you're kind of subtly fighting with it. Or in all these ways, we create this very subtle tension in our experience. So equanimity is starting to notice that and just taking a deep breath, you know, softening through the front of the belly. I mean, if you're anyone's listening, you can do it now. You just sort of soften through the front, soften the face, and you just imagine the experience, in this case, the sound wave of my voice, just floating right through you, and there's no rigidity or no bracing. And it has a particular feeling. There's a kind of open feeling. And this turns out to be this huge contemplative mystery, because what I've just described right there is on a continuum, and you can get more and more and more open. And as you get more and more open, the experiences that you have, it's like the neurons fire, but they don't wire. Like you have these experiences, but you don't lay down as much conditioning. And eventually it seems like almost no conditioning. So in other words, say someone says something that pisses you off, normally you're reactive and you might respond. Instead, you just totally open to that feeling of wanting to lash out. And you can literally metabolize that sensation, that pattern. So it's less likely to be repeated later. So it's the opposite of conditioning in the sense of reinforcing a new pattern. The more open you are, the more patterns kind of get, the wind comes out of their sails, and you can actually start to reverse certain kinds of patterns. So it's absolutely essential to understand that in terms of behavior change, how equanimity works. And I actually think that a lot of people understand this in their own words in different ways. Like there's people talk about it within psychotherapy as catharsis, or it's talked about in different modes. And I think a lot of people probably have an intuitive sense of how it works. But you know, for me, that was something that was always that I actually was pretty good at. So even in times when I'd be really ADD, I could notice you know, I might not be great at concentrating, but I was still good at existing. You know, it's like I could just sit and open to my experience and see where I was. And I had the clarity to notice where I would be going into these spirals of judgment about it, and to not feed that, and just to be equanimous with those reactions. And then they would just, you know, they would phase out. So in other words, I would go into periods of my life where I'd be more productive from the kind of typical ways in which we imagine you need to be productive in the West, you know, getting shit done and emails and writing. Then I go through phases where I was more blown out, but more equanimous, and it wasn't as productive a work time, but it was great for in the moment, teachy stuff. It was good for, you know, just being a human being and hanging out with my friends and doing whatever I needed to do.
So, you know, one of the things that I was curious about, you know, that after reading this book, I'm curious, what misperceptions do people have about a meditation practice? And, you know, it's funny because you referenced the practice going well and the practice not going well. And, I think one of the things that challenges people with that idea is, okay, am I doing it right or am I doing it wrong? Which I think we can all agree that there is no right or wrong way to do this.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no. There's this is the thing. There are windows and there are walls in a practice. So there are opportunities that emerge in a practice, and then there's a right move you can do that will deepen that opportunity. Similarly, there are walls you can hit in a practice, and there are ways in which there are things you can do that are more helpful and less helpful when you hit those walls. So it's sort of like, basically the best answer is meditation is like life. You don't get a manual for how to live your life. You know, there are certain rules you can think about, certain guidelines are going to be helpful, but at different times, different things are going to need to apply. You're going to have to switch up your strategy. So generally in a practice, you can learn the basics of how to do a technique. You can be intelligent about how you're practicing. You can learn a little bit about, like, or either by working with a teacher or figuring it out on your own or in community, about how to take advantage of certain openings. But even having said that, there will be times when you may need to switch up your practice, and you may need to check in with a different teacher or with a different, try a new strategy. And unfortunately, there is no manual that can tell you exactly when to do those things. But having said that, it's also enormously simple just to start. You know, it's like, in some ways, it's very, very simple. You start, you pay attention to your breath or whatever you want to do. You just let that be what it is. And there are some practices that are just about sitting and not doing anything. And that can be a fine practice. But knowing a bit of theory around it can help you when you suddenly have an opportunity that arises in the practice to go, say, deeper, which can happen. Then you can sort of take advantage of that. So I'm not sure if that was that clear, my response to you, but I mean, I'm still – the most honest response is, after 15 years of serious sitting and practicing, I am still trying to figure it out. You know, I'm still learning all the time. I'm still changing my practice. You know, I can't imagine – not having my practice. I love, at the end of the day, being able to sit and just sit inside my experience and the feelings of intimacy and connection and openness and the sanity that emerges. It's so much more noticeable than it was when I began. So it's very obvious for me that it had a huge benefit, but it has been a continuous learning experience. And you know, the second you think you've got it figured out is when it turns around and bites you in the ass. So you really, being humble is kind of like the name of the game as well in the practice.
So, you know, it's interesting you brought up sanity of all things. And to me, you know, I think the big draw for meditation was that, okay, this could, you know, alleviate symptoms of depression or anxiety or, you know, tendencies to ruminate. And there's also a strange irony in that, right? Because what you're paying attention to are the very things that you have a tendency to ruminate on. So I'm curious, how you get to the point where you're actually benefiting from it. Because I think if there's one thing that made the entire book worth reading for me, it was this one equation that I remember seeing in the book, and I wrote it down. I even Instagrammed it. It was that suffering is equal to pain times resistance. And I thought so much about that, and I said, okay, yeah, there are a lot of painful things that, you know, we experience as human beings, whether it's something, you know, job-related, career-related, relationship-related. And, you know, our natural tendency is to resist that pain, I think, for so many people. So I'm curious, how you develop a practice that helps you alleviate suffering when the reality is that you're actually giving attention to these very things that are causing you to suffer, if that makes any sense at all.
It totally does. No, you nailed it. You nailed one of the paradoxes of practice, or at least the part that's least intuitive, which is this notion of kind of moving into our discomfort. So, I mean, there's a couple things to say. First of all, as a meditative strategy, that's one strategy. It's no better or worse than other strategies. Like a strategy of focusing away, you know, if you had physical pain or emotional pain, focusing instead on the breath, that's a legitimate strategy. Or a strategy of deliberately generating kind of friendliness and loving kindness to your compassion to yourself, that's a legitimate strategy. But the essence of a mindfulness strategy is to work with what's actually happening in your experience, to not trying to just say, okay, this is where I am, this is the human being I am, and these are the things I'm feeling, including this discomfort, and this is where I'm going to begin. And the key skill is exactly the skill I was trying to describe earlier, equanimity. So that equation, suffering equals pain times resistance, is one that my teacher Shin Zen uses. It's one that it's a really brilliant reformulation of pretty much what's understood in Buddhism around the nature of equanimity. And what you hear many teachers say is that you can't avoid pain in this life. You know, you're going to have physical pain, you're going to have emotional pain and mental anguish. But what you can do is avoid making it worse. And the way we make it worse is by resisting it, fighting it, blocking it, grabbing onto it, all the different ways in which we basically amplify the signal of that pain. And that amplified signal becomes the suffering. So, and just to give you a vivid example, so I'll tell you how to work with it, because that was your question. And I'll just give you the example of, let's say you have physical pain in your knee, just to make it very simple. Mm-hmm. You're sitting, and this happens to a lot of practitioners, you got physical pain in your knee. You're like trying to pay attention to your breath, but your knee just keeps on bugging the hell out of you, and it just seems to be getting worse. And so one strategy is to focus away, and if your concentration is strong enough, you can get absorbed in another sensation, and it kind of just disappears, that pain. But the going into it strategy is super interesting. What you do is you first locate the sense of it, so the feeling of right around the knee, and you kind of go right into it. You kind of notice, where's the center of the pain, where are the edges, and as soon as you start doing that, where are the edges, you often start seeing that the pain itself is fairly manageable and local. It's just around the knee, but all around the knee there's these waves of little of resistance, of suffering, of ways in which your body is tensing a little bit, or ways in which in your head your inner talk is like, oh God, I can't handle this knee pain, I need to get away from this knee pain, I need to get out of here. Or there's an image of your knee swollen and full of gangrene, or who knows what it is. You know, you've got all those things amplify the original signal, and that's what's really, that's the challenge, that's the suffering that you're inside. So mindfulness just says, okay, divide and conquer. Just pay attention to this one pain signal in my knee, that's it. And as you do that, all that other stuff starts to calm down, and then you just notice it's just sensations, and you just feel it as sensations. And eventually, if you can be open enough, you can get this thing called purification, or basically this moment where it kind of breaks up, you know, call it metabolizing it. You're so open to the feeling of pain in your knee that it ceases to become a problem, and then it just kind of breaks up. You just realize it's just energy. It's just, you know, it's just sensations. So that, and that same skill can be used for emotional pain. You know, so if you have a heartache, you know, at first you might not want to go into it, and there is a smart move here around pacing yourself, and we talk about how to do that in the book around this sort of RAIN formula that a lot of other teachers use. So you kind of pace yourself a bit, but when you feel ready to open to it, you just let yourself kind of go in there and try to explore the sensation around where you feel that heartache, say. And often it increases. So that, just what you said, as soon as you start to open to something or notice it, it often gets worse. But then there can be a period where if you're really opening and not fighting with it, it kind of passes through you. And you kind of reset. You come back into the moment. You know, you come back into where you are, and now that thing that was there has moved a little bit. It's more fluid. It's more, and this really is the big picture of a practice, dude. It's like, that's what you're kind of moving towards. You're moving towards a place of more fluidity, where you're able to be more responsive to what's actually happening in the moment, and you're not holding on and gripping on to all this stuff, these old stories, these old feelings, that heartache you, and let it express itself. And when you let it express itself, it does, and then you can move through into the next iteration of you. But what we do instead is we're kind of holding on to all these little parts of us, little ruminative patterns we're holding on to, old grudges, feelings. You know, there's all this gripping and coagulation in the sensory system. And so meditation teaches you how to make things more free-flowing. And as you do that, guess what? You're more able to just show up in the moment for other people. You're more present with other people. You can see the character in their faces. You're not just looking at your own projections everywhere. And there's a friendliness that can also kind of come up through that. And so really, it fucking rocks. I mean, the thing is, you're crazy not to at least try meditating, because it can really make a huge difference. I mean, if you've been doing it for a while, I'd love to hear your stories.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can tell you that it has made a huge difference in my ability to focus. I'll tell you what, there are a couple of things that sold me on the habit. One was I consistently noticed this pattern that nearly every billionaire who a book had been written about had referenced a meditation habit. I was like, that's a pretty convincing case. you know, I was like, okay, that's a convincing enough case. But then I had a mentor who told me, you know, he said, human beings are the only species with the capacity to pause between stimulus and response. And I said, well, what's the key to developing that capacity? He said, meditation.
That's it, dude. Yeah, that's really it. So it's learning to live in that space more and more. And what people don't understand is people think, oh, somehow that seems counter to life or something. Like, I want to be in the vehicle of life. I want to be responding. And you can do all that. It's more like it just takes out all the friction. So you feel those things more fully. You feel like you're more in your life, but you're also more in that bubble of sanity where you feel like you can respond. It's kind of like that. It's cheesy, but it's like the Matrix or something, where there's that dude moving in slow motion and dodging the bullets. Like, you just have more space to be able to respond to things, especially when you stop caring, like, about you know how you're looking or what you need to say in this moment, or stop. You stop being in your mind full of strategies about things, and you just pop land right here where you are, and you just start to trust nature to say the right thing through you. So when you meet people who are really on the deep end of this path, like, you know, not me, like my teachers, you know, or Joseph Goldstein or Shinzen Young or Sharon Salzberg or whoever, they have this. There is a real. There can be that freedom, that fluidity. There's a certain quality that they have of, like, of suppleness of how they're moving through things, and it's, you know, that's where the practice leads. It's interesting.
Wow. What are the sort of unexpected benefits that you've seen in the lives of people, I mean, that you've profiled in this book, as well as in your own lives as a result of this?
Well, what I was interested in with the book, with all the people we met there, was just how, I mean, these are just really practical people, like, you know, cops and military people and caregivers and every kind of, you know, we met so many different groups of people, and they were just really interested in, like, how can I just practically apply these skills now in my job to make it to be a better police officer, to be a better caregiver, to be a better politician. And it was working for a lot of them. That was what was so interesting. And in this very down-to-earth way, you know, it was just giving them more time to pause, like you said, more of that feeling like being in that in the space between stimulus and response. It was a way for them to regulate their emotions sometime. I'd heard that from people, or to honor the, but including honoring the hard emotions, you know. So there's all these kind of more it's like, it just helps you become who you are more fully. It helps you be more of a human being. And I don't know you know, I think it's kind of the kind of practice is going to depend a little bit on the person, and people are going to get different benefits, but that does seem to be sort of an overall benefit there. And then there's people that I know who've done it more long term. And I really see the differences there, where people are just much less reactive, you know, much less prone to anger or triggered like that. But the really beautiful part is this sense of, like, you know, of intimacy that kind of emerges. And I kind of, you know, I experienced this too at times, where you're just, you know, connected to the privilege of being here and the mystery of it, the feeling of waking up and looking out of the world and not taking it for granted, and being, you know, able to see the people that you're passing on the street, you know, able to be curious about stuff outside of you. That's the biggest, for me, the biggest shift. You know, mm-hmm. I was just such a narcissist and just so agonized with my own shit. And yeah, I'm still working on it, but you get a break from you. It's like, and it's so nice to have a break from you. You know, yeah, you get a break from you by being compassionate about how you are, but that inner world is less filled up with your own schemes and strategizing, and it's just there for, and so that then that you're open to the serendipities, to surprise, to the mystery, which really is a mystery, because it just feels more and more profound and weird that you're here at all, and you're tuned into that frequency, but not in a way that paralyzes you, more in a way that helps you appreciate things. And oh yeah, another thing I should say is the energy efficiency. Like I think I said at the beginning, you're like, you get more tuned into your, you know, metabolism, and it's like, I don't need to expend all this energy in the same way, or all this stuff. Because you think, oh, you're always thinking, oh, I got to do this, I got to do this. You have all these ideas of what you got to do or who you got to be, and you're just spinning the wheels and pouring out your energy. It's like this friend of mine, Scott, who used to like pour out all this awesome, crazy energy at 3 a.m. and just do the most beautiful riffs, beatific firebombs of like creativity into the air, but nobody was around to see it. You know, he would just blow it out. And it's sort of like, and that was beautiful for its own sake, but it's like you start to notice where you're expending that energy and decide, is this the best use of my time right now? Or maybe what I need to be doing is just chilling in nature. And so there's just this calibration that happens. I guess it's wisdom, you know, and because old people got it, at least the ones who are learning stuff. So that, so you, sometimes you could think of it as, or how I think of it is meditation accelerates the aging gracefully gradient. It like makes you a wise old geezer in the prime of your life, or more like that.
Wow. Wow. Well, this has been really, really eye-opening and insightful. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, I think everyone's already unmistakable. You know, I think it's whether they notice it or not, and whether they can actually clear out some of that space to be able to see that not just you, but every single person you meet is this phenomenal, you know, this blooming thing. And the standards by which you judge something to be quote important, quote creative, you know, valuable, all those ideas that we inherit from our culture turn out to be bullshit, basically, because the only standard is the standard of existence, and on that standard we're all perfect, you know. And when you see the world more and more from that, you get less interested in hanging out with quote interesting people and more interested in just being there for whatever is coming up. And so I think that it's for me a spiritual practice, whatever you want to call it. It's a practice that's about connecting to your own being. That is the thing that will most potentiate your own unmistakableness and your own ability to recognize that in everybody else. So I guess those are some words about that.
Awesome. Where can people learn more about you, your work, and the book?
Well, the book is 10% Happier, it's called. No, it's called the 10% Happier How-To Book. It's called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. And that's, you'll see it ad nauseum across every airport and bookstore that you have the good fortune of coming across. And you can find it on all the usual retail bestseller things. I should mention the app, 10% Happier. Really, there's lots of cool meditation apps. I find this one great. You know, I'm biased because it's the only one I've really checked out, but it's got video, which I like. So you can kind of, and I use it as well for guided meditations with other teachers. I'm in there, other people are in there. Has Dan's sense of humor. I have a website, jeffwarren.org. You can check out, I got writing there about random deep end of the tool stuff. My friend keeps telling me I need to update it with more accessible articles, but I just write whatever's coming up. And then I have the Consciousness Explorers Club, which is a kind of meditation adventure group in Toronto, but we're really building towards becoming a global resource. We're a nonprofit. We're trying to help people start up communities of practice anywhere in the world, and we're going to have scripts and meditations and all that stuff on the website, which people can download. So those are some things. You can check that out and try meditating. Why not? You might be surprised.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.